Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease.
Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, we have a very special guest, a woman that means a lot to me in real life, in mitochondrial disease life. And I'm very excited for her to share her story with you. She wears a lot of hats, and I think that all of you will really benefit from learning from her and where her head's at. I want everyone to know that she's not only responsible for caring for her own health, but the health and well-being of her own two children, and also for the greater community through the work that she does. So welcome, Rachel. It's so good to have you.
Hi, Marcy. Thank you.
So let's kick this off. I think the best way to do it is to give you some time to speak about, you know, both areas of your life. And I know they're both very important to you. So we will give you time to kind of talk about your career and about mother life, about mom life. But let's kind of first give everyone a baseline of who you are, you know, your diagnostic journey, some of the struggles that you have on a daily basis, and then we'll talk more about the other things.
So I was born with this, obviously, as most people are born with Mito. I don't think that my symptoms have changed a huge amount, but I wasn't diagnosed until I was about 17, almost 18. So when I was diagnosed back in early 1998, I was just given a diagnosis of mitochondrial myopathy, kind of not otherwise specified. I was told that part of that is CPEO, which is this thing that many people have, chronic progressive external ophthalmoplegia, which is the limitation of eye movements, of the weakness, particularly of the muscles that move the eyes. It's like how you and I even first encountered each other is because we both were in this group for that. And at the time, I feel like the understanding of the field of diagnoses of mitochondrial disease was so different and now has progressed so much. So I guess at this point, I would have a diagnosis of primary mitochondrial myopathy, or maybe this thing that they call CPEO plus. I'm not actually sure. And I feel like I should ask my neurologist. It's just never something I've thought to refresh is like whatever my diagnostic name is now.
My understanding of CPEO is the effect in the eyes.
Right.
And then CPEO plus is if you do have the muscular myopathy throughout your body, which you do.
That's probably what I have. Yeah, I have. It basically affects my skeletal muscles. Doesn't seem to affect other sort of internal organs or smooth muscles or whatever, you know, although no one totally knows for sure. But so far, I haven't had any issues. And it tends to affect more distal muscles, like the farther away, like my hands are worse than like my core, I guess. So I was always kind of a small and like weak and runty kid. And I had like a lot of deep anxieties about physical stuff, about sports, about running around, but I sort of floated under the radar as like just one of those unathletic kind of kids. You know, I was good at academics, so that kind of helped me stay in my lane and like not sort of question why I felt so kind of incapable in the physical arena. And I did see doctors about it at least once. My parents took me when I was like 10 or 11 because I was really small, kind of smaller than they thought I should be for that age. And they did like some basic tests and they basically assessed that I was like normal, but kind of on the lower range, and that I would probably go through puberty and like sort of get stronger and bigger. And then I did go through puberty, but like, and I think I floated a little bit more under the radar, but then it was actually my eyes that led my parents to take me to a neurologist again, like at 16 or 17. Not the movement issues, but like the droopy eyelids, the ptosis, which is a common part of CPEO. And I was just complaining about other kids at school noticing it. And so my dad, who incidentally is a pediatrician, took me in again. And at that point, I guess enough looked off. There had been some progression of the movements of the eyes, limitation of the movements of the eyes. So they sent me for a muscle biopsy. And so that's how I got diagnosed ultimately, it was by muscle biopsy of my thigh. And after I had nerve conduction studies and the electromyelogram, the EMG, which is the study many Mino people might be familiar with, where they like test the electric impulses in your muscles. So there wasn't a blood test back then. So people have asked me about blood tests. And once they knew the mutation I had, they could look for how much of it was in my blood, but there wasn't like a overall blood test to say if you had Mino.
That's interesting. So have you thought about going back and being retested with today's testing?
Yeah, well, you've mentioned that. I mean, I hadn't even thought of it until you suggested that. And now I think about it, you know, it didn't occur to me. I think part of the psychology of this is like, I got diagnosed and I was like, not going to let this affect me, or I'm going to do my life. Like nothing, it doesn't change anything. There's no treatment. You know, nobody knows what's going to happen, if it's going to get worse, you know? So like, I just sort of like doubled down on like living as normal in life as possible. And I kind of like never went back to consider it, but it's totally something I should think about and do, because who knows what other info I could get.
Right, right. I think now's a good time to also tell our listeners how we became connected. We were in the CPO support group through Mito Action, and we saw each other there a few times, but then Stephanie Harry, the patient advocate for Mito Action, suggested that we connect personally. She thought that the two of us would really have a wonderful, special connection. And she was right. She couldn't have done it better.
And there were things about us that she had no way of knowing.
Yeah.
Where we would have in common, that we have in common.
She hit the nail on the head.
She totally did.
And now Rachel is a very special confidant in my life. Someone that I talk to about issues relating to this disease. And you even mentioned it a minute ago, the psychology of it all. I mean, that's something that could be a whole episode of a podcast. The mental components of, you know, feeling different and, you know, less than. And we talk about that a lot with each other and our kids and all of that. So I am lucky to have you in my life. I really, really am. So yeah, I think that it would be interesting to see what your blood results would look at.
Yeah, no, I totally should go back. I mean, another part of the psychology of this, I think that we could get into it for a whole nother hour podcast, is that I'm like a little bit avoidant.
Yeah.
At times of the medical system as it, which is ironic because I'm a doctor, I'm a physician now. And my dad was a physician, and I, you know, that I should probably talk with like a shrink about the connections there, but like, you know, I think because of the time I was diagnosed and the way that it was sort of presented or processed or whatever it was, I sort of got like a learned helplessness a little bit. Like I think I just decided that like there was nothing that the medical system was going to be able to offer me, both in terms of like support and like anyone that looked like me or had anything similar. I mean, I was just basically told like, you're one in a million.
And you're a sporadic case as far as you know too, right? Which is very unusual.
Well, I don't think I knew at the time that it was that unusual. I mean, I knew, like, it was always explained to me that the mitochondrial myopathies can be inherited or sporadic, and that like mine is sporadic, and that there were some number, like I think they told me at the time 30 or so that were identified, that were like named, that were known as syndromes, you know, like, and so what mine was just a random mutation without a name, like not Kearns Sayre, not MELAS, not one of these ones that we think about, and like when we think about mitochondrial named syndromes. And so I actually think that was the part that felt so like mystifying and isolating. Like every doctor I saw, including the ones who diagnosed me, would say like, nobody really knows anything about what I have. And they figured it wasn't inherited because nobody else in my family seemed to have symptoms, and they couldn't find my mutation in my mom's hair, skin, blood, whatever. And so they thought I couldn't pass it on, but like nobody knew for sure. And my case seemed mild, and like they thought it wouldn't really worsen a huge amount and I would live a pretty normal lifespan, but they couldn't be sure. So, and they wrote a case study about me, the doctors that diagnosed me. So that's how novel it was. Like there's an article in the literature that's like a 21-year-old female and like, it's me. So I think that also contributed to me feeling like, well, you know, no one's ever going to be able to like give me answers. So like, why am I going to go get more tests? You know, which is like a silly thing to do for 20 years, but that is what it is. And so, and there was no Mito action. So I didn't, it never like occurred to me that I would in my life come into contact with someone who had something similar, let alone a whole like support group of people. And I guess, you know, I'll also, we talked about this, like even connecting to support groups within Mito Action and connecting with you, Marcy, like nobody is quite like me. Like you and I have so many things in common. You're the first person I really saw with like eyes that look like mine, kind of. And that was like so meaningful to me. And we both have kids and we're similar in age and we both have this similar Jewish backgrounds and like all of this, but still we have a lot of differences in our symptoms and our experience of the disease. So I think I just sort of assumed I would always feel kind of isolated and didn't think I could go to doctors to like feel less isolated.
I mean, for someone with mitochondrial disease, I think everything you said makes a lot of sense. I think it's hard to understand when you're not in that position, but what would it really change?
Right. That was what I wondered. But you know, you never know. Like I never thought there would be a Mito Action and a Stephanie Harry and a Marcy Young, you know? So I sort of, this is kind of led me to believe like, don't assume, you know, and I didn't even look for Mito Action. My husband found it for me because he was like, why do you never like look, why do you never like look into what you have? So, and I think he was sort of like, there's gotta be a group, you know? But I think I looked in like, you know, around at the internet in the late 90s and didn't see anything.
And thought you swore it off at that point, you know?
I kind of put it out of my mind. Yeah. It's good. It's good to be connecting in these different ways, having people kind of shake me up a little.
I mean, there are times in life that are really difficult and for very unusual reasons that aren't similar to what our contemporaries are, you know, I have those issues too. You know, me and my girlfriend a few streets away, you know, yes, we can relate to each other on, you know, our son not wanting to go to basketball practice or, you know, all these other things. But this deep stuff about like who we are and what our life path looks like is different. And it's important to really find these connections. And Mito Action is really good about helping us not feel so isolated. I mean, I've felt so much more comfortable about just like talking about who I am since getting involved in the organization. So let's talk about your life as a mom. So you have two little kids and I know how proud you are of being a mom and who you're raising and they're wonderful. I've actually been able to meet them in person. We had a really special brunch a couple months ago when they were passing through my hometown. Tell us about life as a mom. Tell us about, you know, where you feel like, you know, you're struggling in that area and also where you feel like you are doing great. I mean, I think our listeners should hear both.
Okay, well, so like any other mom or like parent, the biggest challenges kind of keep shifting all the time. Like the kids change and like you learn things and they learn things. And I think early on, I had a lot of fears that I couldn't be an adequate mom. So my kids are now 6 and 2, and I came to motherhood as I came to medicine, like kind of later than most people, because I think I had a lot of fears about my capability of doing it and it being a reality for me. And so, you know, I still have the fears about adequacy, but I think having been a mom for 6 years now, I also have some lived experience of being adequate. And that gives me a bit more confidence that like I have areas of strength like any other parent. When my kids were a lot younger, I think my big challenge was anxiety that I couldn't keep them physically safe. So like I can't lift them after like 12 or 15 pounds probably.
So that's before they're 1 year old.
Yeah, I guess I can probably lift them. It's complicated. I can't get my kids off the ground after like 15 or 20 pounds. But my kids are like 30, 40 pounds now. And like my husband lifts them into my arms, I can hold them up for a while. But like, you know, so there's different limitations and it's, and sometimes it's dependent on like my particular energy level at that moment or that day. And it's a little bit unpredictable. But I was going to say, I remember this time when my kids were like, I don't know, maybe the bigger one was 4 and the little one was like crawling or starting to pull up and stuff. And I decided I could take them down to the playground at the end of our block because my husband needed to work or rest or something. And I was like, I really, you know, I need to be able to do this. And so my younger one was just the crawling sort of half toddler one was just like really adventurous. And she would try to climb up the steps of this big play structure. And I could kind of manage her and keep her in check. But then she was really scrambling up the steps. And of course, the 4-year-old was no help. She was like running around trying to like not. And I totally panicked. Like, I think my little one got up farther than I expected. And I knew I couldn't like lift her and walk her down. And I ended up basically in a panic calling my husband near tears to come rescue us because I just felt like so worried that like we were going to be kind of high up on this structure and like I wouldn't be able to get to my 4-year-old without like, you know, leaving my baby. And I felt so ashamed that I couldn't just like throw a kid or two over my shoulder if they were getting out of hand, you know? And so I think, and I still feel that way, like they're much easier to reason with now, but not being able to lift them is probably my biggest challenge. Playground stuff, like if they want to be lifted into a swing, if I'm not near my husband on the playground, bathing them is like a really physical thing. You and I have talked about that. Stairs while carrying anything is a big challenge. So either a kid or like a kid's stuff during like pickup or whatever, or drop off. So, you know, I think those are the main challenges. I mean, I guess my strengths are like talking to my kids, the kind of more emotional, like playing with my kids, like quietly.
I want you to feel good about those things though. I mean, the emotional support that you provide for your children is unparalleled to where, you know, to getting it from others.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, my mom also had CPEO plus and she couldn't do a lot of the things that you're describing. And all I remember of her, because she is gone now, is how loving she was and how supportive she was and how she talked to me about my feelings and all of the things that you're saying that you are so good at. And I have such fond memories and I wouldn't have expected her to do one other thing for me, you know, because everybody does excel in one area or another, you know. And just like you said, when you were a kid, you focused more on academics because you could see inadequacies when you were, you know, playing ball. So I don't want you to feel less than, because whatever you can give to your kids, you're pushing through in those areas, you know?
I do feel in many moments like a good parent. And I also think like I'm showing my kids a different way of being in the world. And like, you know, not everyone kind of has the same capacity. And I think that's important for kids to get. So, you know, I think, yeah, there's a lot more to parenting than the physical stuff. And I always joke, like, you know, when my kids are teenagers, that's when I'll really shine, you know, when they can like toilet and bathe themselves. I also think that there's probably something to that. So
I think that line that you said that not everyone has the same capacity, no matter, you know, talking about this stuff with your kids, you know, the rare disease life, it's very difficult. And we've had episodes about that. And I think just being able to say to your kids, not everyone has the same capacity. I can't do that today. You know, is them understanding. They'll be so much more empathetic to others in life down the road. I mean, think about how many types of people they're going to encounter, and they're going to be so much more understanding. As I do think of myself and you, I think we're way more empathetic about those that we interact with because of what we're going through, you know? And there'll be struggles when they're teenagers too, you know? And we'll just kind of have to go through it, and hopefully we can go through that together as well. And, you know, kind of roll with it and do what we can in the areas that we can. So do your kids know anything specific? What do they know about like mom versus dad in terms of this rare disease?
You know, the oldest one is 6. So like they haven't really asked and I haven't really talked to them directly about much yet. I have told my older daughter, you know, things like, you know, mommy can't lift you. Like if she's like demanding that, or no, mommy can't chase you. Like she's always trying to do a race with me down the street. And I'm like, I can let dad do that, you know? So I don't really know what she thinks. I only very recently once tried to kind of open a conversation about why I'm not very strong and telling her you know, did you ever wonder, like, I was born like this, and it's like how some people have a wheelchair or can't see or whatever, like it's just a difference. And she was just like, uh-huh, cool. Did you know Sophia has a unicorn notebook? Like, she just was like totally uninterested. She was like, whatever, mom.
You know, some of it resonated, even though she responded about a unicorn notebook.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're right. Kids are always listening, right? But I remember once a couple of years ago, you know, when she was a little younger, she was like, mommy, you're not as strong as daddy. And I was like, yeah, do you know why? Like, internally, I'm sort of like scrambling, like prepping for like hard questions. And she was like, yeah, it's because you're shorter. Like, she, and that was that. So I think like the refreshing thing about little kids is they sort of just accept whatever is in front of them if it's always been there, you know? So they're not like, they haven't expressed curiosity, but I think my plan is to just be fully forthcoming with them. It's kind of a complicated thing for that, for their age at this point. So far, neither of them has shown any signs, even that I think I showed at that age. So it doesn't seem like they have inherited anything, but we can never know for sure. And I did go to genetic counselors before I had them, or when I was pregnant with my first, and sort of just decided we're not going to test for anything unless there's something that shows up, because it didn't seem worth it. I don't really know what it's going to be like when they start asking, but I do plan to just sort of tell them as much as I know.
And honestly, I feel like I've worked so hard mentally to like prepare for what I will tell them, and I have nothing.
They might surprise you.
I don't know that I'm necessarily doing it the right way. I don't know the best time to talk to them. You know, I see why you wouldn't with your kids. But I see why I wouldn't with my kids, and my kids are older than yours, you know? So it's a struggle. It's a big topic. And I'm glad that we're talking about it, because my mom didn't have the benefits of Mito Action and all that it provides. And these are things that need to be heard. And I hope that there's people listening that are kind of like shaking their heads like, oh my gosh, I know I'm in this boat too, you know? So Rachel, you've established with us that you are a physician, and I really hope that you are deep down proud of the work that you're doing. I'd love for our listeners to hear what made you want to go into medicine, the type of work you were doing, and now the type of work that you do today.
My dad is a doctor, so I think I always had a consciousness of that, and I always had a kind of similar mind as him, and similar capacities, similar interests. So I was always really, really curious about the science of medicine. I always kind of liked science as a kid, but I also knew, and I think this became even more obvious after my diagnosis, that like I wasn't really cut out for a schooling or a career that was like physically demanding or demanding of energy. But when I was in college, you know, I studied science and I was taking basically all the pre-med requirements, but kind of like dancing around the idea of medical school, kind of evading it, of actually applying. I was afraid of it for a really long time. I just thought there was no way. And so I did a public health degree first. I worked for a while. I kind of circled around what was always a real desire to learn clinical medicine. And I think public health was a way to like get into that and learn about sort of the field. I really love public health. And I think ultimately, the reason I went to medical school was because I thought I would always be kicking myself if I didn't try. And if I just sort of said, I'm too afraid to do this. And I had to keep telling myself, like, you can always quit if you want to, which is kind of a crazy thing to say, because medical school is like such an investment of time and money. And it's like not so easy to just say, like, I could just go for a year and quit, you know? But I think I had to tell myself that in order to be able to face the, you know, trying it, kind of delude myself in that way.
Take the pressure off a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so a little bit of like mental gymnastics. Like, I also always told myself that I was the most interested in the kind of medicine that I ended up training in, like public health focused primary care. But like, how do I know that wasn't some other kind of mental gymnastics? I will never know. Like, I was never going to be like an orthopedic surgeon, like fixing people's bones into place. That is just a different kind of personality, I think, and capacity. So we were living after residency, I had just gotten married. We were living in like a suburb in a house, and we moved back to New York City. And because that's where I did my residency and started dating and married my husband in New York City. Part of why we moved back was because there's some family here. And part of it was job related. I was working in primary care. And moving back to New York City, I sort of moved away from direct patient care to like disease investigations and surveillance work. I work at the city health department, and I really do public health, you know, medical epidemiology. And so my job is a desk job now, which is just much better suited to my needs and my strengths. And I really love it. And a big part of those changes were actually in conversation with my husband, because I have this tendency from, which is learned, to just kind of put my head down and try to push through without looking up to assess the situation. And I think that that's because it's kind of what I always had to do, being this kid who like didn't know there was any larger reason that I struggled with everything. With all of these things, I just sort of got by just gritting my teeth and kind of maneuvering where I could, and like enough to kind of do a passable job, kind of hiding things, certain things, and kind of doing as much as I could, if that makes sense. And so it was my husband who, like, when I was working full time as a primary care doctor, we were like gonna either about to have our first child or even right after we did, he was like, "You are miserable. Like, you're suffering, and like, you're miserable to be around, and we need to make a change." And I was really defensive at the time, and I kind of still am. I mean, I kind of was like, "I'm fine, you know, I'm doing it, you know." But I'm ultimately really lucky that he's able to observe me and tell me, like, when our family can't function in the ways that I'm used to functioning to get by. You know, part of the change was a change I always said I was interested in making, but it's really much easier on me to maintain kind of full-time work.
So do you feel as fulfilled in the work that you're doing now? Do you miss the daily patient care in person?
I feel more fulfilled.
Really?
Honestly. Yeah, I don't miss it.
Okay, good.
I think, you know, there was something that I got out of my relationships with patients.
Yeah.
But I think I was always trying to like force a square peg into a round hole a little bit. And I think the moments that were satisfying and fulfilling were totally outweighed by the fact that I was like always playing against type. There are these like personality or like professional quizzes you can take where it's like, where should you work so that you're not struggling against your innate personality all the time? And I feel like that was like a good example of me sort of working really hard to like push through what sort of I felt more natural doing, push against what I sort of felt more natural doing. I never liked the kind of pace of seeing a patient every 20 minutes or 15 minutes. I never liked the sort of physicality of like examining people. It was just not my comfort space. And I think that what I'm doing now, I really feel like I'm well suited for, and I feel a lot of satisfaction.
Good. From what you've told me, it's very interesting. You focus a bit on COVID now, right?
I do. Yeah. Well, the COVID surveillance work, which now is like not emergency activation work.
But you worked through that.
Yeah, I did. I worked through. That's kind of how I ended up getting into this desk job, was that I was actually seeing patients when we first moved back to New York City. And within a few months of moving here, COVID hit. And because I had this background in public health and had worked prior to medical school, they tapped me as a doctor who could come work in the like emergency activation, surveillance, and tracking data side. And I started to do that. They like pulled me out of the clinic to do that. And I loved it. And I applied for a job in that actual unit, sort of away from the clinics and within the health department. So I always tell people, like, it took a global pandemic for me to get my dream job.
That's a funny way of saying it, you know, but you're right.
Yeah. So, you know, I was doing basically only COVID for quite a while. And now I'm within a unit that does more like respiratory disease.
Oh, interesting.
So I do a lot of flu, RSV.
Your work is really important.
Yeah. And it's really interesting.
Yeah. And you are so intelligent. And I feel like this is really keeping your brain like stimulated.
My dad does this too, which is really fascinating because he doesn't have a mitochondrial disease as far as I know. But I kind of retreat into my brain as like a safe, competent place.
Uh-huh. I love that.
It's where I can feel my power.
Would you ever want to work in mitochondrial care, do you think? Has that ever crossed your mind?
It really never has. I never have considered it. And I think my instinct is that I would want to stay far away from that. Honestly, I think it's like how doctors shouldn't treat their own families, or like how they make the worst patients themselves, which I do, because they're too close to be objective. And I think I have so much raw emotion surrounding my mitochondrial disease, and
it would be triggering on a daily basis.
It's complicated. Yeah, I think it would be complicated psychologically. And a lot of that is like being improved now by having MitoAction and by having a friendship with you and meeting others. But like, it's still kind of fragile. And I just can't see bringing my career there too, you know? Maybe it's like what I just said, like my career mentally is like my safe zone. And I've never desired that. And I think I'd like be way too enmeshed with the patients that I would see, you know, and the research. And I think it would be messy.
That's okay. That's totally okay. So you've talked a little bit about the support that your husband has given you.
Well, I guess we've been married about 8 years now. We've been together like 11. And it's hard to explain something to someone like when you don't fully understand it yourself, or like the outside world doesn't understand it. You know, we did couples therapy early in our marriage, actually before we had kids, or just when we were starting to have kids. And a huge part of what we talked about was my mitochondrial condition and like how that affected like my approaches to things, my anxieties, the way that I communicate my needs, my trust in not just him, but like my own body or lack of trust. And I guess we also did talk about his childhood at some point, but I think that Mito was really the central player in our couples therapy. And like, as it has been in much of my own individual therapy, since I have a hard time knowing like where that line is between what I can do and what I'm afraid of doing and what I can't do. So, I mean, at this point, I would say, like, we've kind of gotten into, like a rhythm of kind of understanding each other. It's always a struggle. Marriage is, like, always something that you have to work on. But, like, I would say he's the main caretaker of, like, my day-to-day condition, besides myself, of course. And I'm fully independent and functional in terms of, like, the things doctors talk about as the activities of daily living and, you know, what you do, but he really takes on a lot of the domestic tasks, certainly the ones that are physical, but even some of the things that I physically can do, like cooking, like I'm just a lot more inefficient at doing those things than he is. And so like, in order for our family to function well, it makes a lot more sense for him to do those things more. And so like, we've had to work through whatever balance issues or stress or resentment or like insecurity comes up for both of us. And that's been really hard. And then he also does the physical things like lifting everything, the children. If we travel, he's all done doing all the suitcases. Like I can't pick up the kids. If we have to get a fitted sheet on the bed, like he's the guy who has to do it. Big food shopping, these things that most other people probably just don't think about as a limitation. And honestly, I believe that he makes it possible for me to have kids and a career that I have. Like, I just think that if you were a different kind of husband or like a different kind of father, I just wouldn't be able to manage it. At least not without like a ton of outside help. Like any marriage, like there's a lot of stuff you have to negotiate. And this is like another thing to negotiate. And I do feel really lucky and I think that, you know, I found him a little bit later than most people find their spouse. I did a lot of things a little later, medical school, kids.
I think we talked through a lot today about how there's struggle, but there's a lot of, you know, way to be successful and work, like kind of working through things and feeling good about ourselves and pivoting. And I really thank you so much for sharing your story, Rachel. It's so important for everyone to kind of hear from each other in this Mito Action world. And I am so thankful to have you in my life and to have you on the show. And this is not going to be the last that you hear from Rachel. We have a couple other episode ideas in mind. And one of them actually does include both of our husbands to talk about, you know, the support and how they struggle. All of these conversations are so important. And I feel like I was, you know, banging my head against a wall before I had Mito Action and before I was able to have these conversations because I felt very alone, you know? So Rachel, thank you so much. And thank you for all the hard work you're doing and in disease investigation and continuing to find your purpose and to be a wonderful mother. And we will hear from you again soon on Energy in Action. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much, Marcy. And thanks. I'm also really grateful for you in my life. So thanks.
Thank you for saying that.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I'm so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.